I'm Tobin Beck from Concordia University in Seward, and I'm here today with Dr. Mark Meal. So welcome, Dr. Meal.
Thank you. It's very good to be here.
So you have had and are having a really interesting, fascinating career. And I want to start off by having you talk a little bit about what you teach here at Concordia.
Oh, okay. I've been teaching at Concordia since the fall of 1991. That was my first semester on campus. And I was hired for the most part to teach Old Testament and Biblical Hebrew. And so those are kind of my major courses right now. So I teach the full Hebrew sequence, 1, 2, and 3, 3 semesters of Hebrew, and then additional readings classes for the advanced Hebrew students. We do readings in the Dead Sea Scrolls, as well as the biblical text. Then I also do, Old Testament survey, New Testament survey for the incoming students. And then I also teach an intertestamental class dealing with the period between the testaments. And then I also, because of my archaeological interest, I teach an archaeology class every other year as well. So kind of a geography and archaeology of the Holy Land class. And then various other, responding to various other needs to the students as they arise. I've done an ancient history course where we study the civilizations of the Mesopotamia, Egypt, and Syro-Palestine, and so on. So whatever the students need, we try and provide in the theology department. I'm happy to do whatever I can with that falls within my realm of expertise.
So you have the reputation as Concordia's Indiana Jones with your archaeological interest and the excavations you've worked on.
I wish I was only that good looking. But yeah. I do share the fear of snakes, though.
Okay. So tell us about what you've done with your archaeological work and how you got interested in that.
I was always interested as a kid in archaeology and ancient civilizations, and then excavating was kind of a, well, we'll see how it works out. And then I found out that I could actually have my travel to the Middle East facilitated by applying for study grants and things like that. So financially, it was kind of a mercenary way for me to get over to a place that I had always wanted to see. But then doing the excavation was actually a bonus. So my first excavation experience was in 1984 at an excavation site that was co-sponsored by the St. Louis Seminary. I traveled over there with Dr. Horace Hummel and Dr. Jonathan Grothy, and we excavated at Abila the Decapolis. And I started my PhD work at Johns Hopkins, and then I got involved with a dig in Israel. One of my goals had always been to be able to bring students over and work on the excavation as well. And the excavation in Israel was much more accessible and had more in contact with the Old Testament period. So I started to work at a Philistine site, Biblical Ekron, Tel Mikne Ekron. And I was living in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins, and a bunch of the other excavators lived in Baltimore as well, teaching at Baltimore Hebrew University and such. So it was a good fit, and they were a very well-heeled dig, and so travel over there was basically free, even as I worked as a volunteer. And then I worked there for, it turns out to be 9 seasons, and moved up through the ranks until I was eventually in charge of an area, which led to me co-publishing a book on the particular area that I worked on within the dig. In between, one of my professors at Hopkins was excavating in Syria, and so I went with him in one fall and was able to get some excavation experience with mud bricks, which is a really difficult task to dig, as well as travel through Syria both before and after the excavation. That was way before the Civil War and the destruction of the antiquities there, but I was able to see them when they were still in pretty good shape and when Assad, the current Assad's father, was still in charge. Military dictatorships are very safe to travel in. They're kind of not so nice for the people to live under, but in terms of us being tourists, it was a pretty good country. People were incredibly interested in me. I didn't speak much Arabic at the time, and I'd pull into these little towns and try and get buses to another next town, and these people would gather around. They'd bring in their token English speaker from the community, and they'd ask, "Why are you here?" They just could not figure out why I would want to leave a country like the United States, which had everything, which was a great place to live, to travel to their very impoverished, dictator regime.
So what would they say when you told them what you were doing?
Most people locals, I don't use that term in a derogatory sense, but just the people who live in the region, always think we're excavating for gold. They don't really understand, well, there's history, there's all this other cultural material we can recover, and that we're much more interested in broken pieces of pottery than finding gold, although we don't turn it down if we find it. But they always think, well, you must be digging for gold. And so they always say, well, I would tell them, well, we're excavating for to understand ancient civilizations. And they'd kind of wink and nod and go, yeah, but you're really looking for gold, aren't you? And they go, well, no, not really. So it's hard for them to understand the full kind of the cultural, pardon the pun, gold mine on which they're living.
So what are some of the more interesting things that you've found?
Well, there's I think the most interesting thing I found was an empty jar. We were excavating at Ekron, and it was a city. The last level was destroyed by the by Nebuchadnezzar in 603 BC when he came through. And so the people hid all their jewelry and things under the floors of their houses, just dirt floors. So they would bury pots under the floor, and then with the hope of coming back and digging it up when the troops went away. Unfortunately for the people at Ekron, they were all hauled off as slaves and their city was completely destroyed. So we were excavating a nice, really nice floor, and we found that this mouth of a jar sticking out of the dirt floor. And you can hardly wait to find out what's in there, because in the room next door to ours, they'd found iron tools from that period, and they'd found gold jewelry and another cache underneath the floor. So we came back after the weekend and excavated very carefully, isolated the jar. It was an intact storage jar about, you know, 2 feet tall. And then we finally removed the stopper that had been placed upon it, and it was empty. So, but it was kind of exciting for the time. We also found some nice ivory pieces. Ivory is really difficult to excavate because it falls apart pretty quickly, but just kind of by the luck of how we were digging, we were able to isolate the piece intact and pull it out, and it's now in the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. So whenever I go back there, I can see stuff that I had excavated in the museum.
So what sorts of information have these digs contributed to better understanding of that period?
Probably the best comes from the earlier periods of the Philistines. And so the Philistines conquered this city around 1200 BC, trashed the Canaanite town that was there, built their own unique architecture and walls on top of it. And so that would be the time of the early Philistines, not so much the ones we read about in the Bible yet, but that early city was destroyed, then the biblical Philistines that we know built another layer on top of it. And so and then that was destroyed when David and Saul conquered the area. So it's always interesting to be in these rooms of buildings and excavating pottery from people who had made it, you know, fought against David or seen him when he walked by. And so we have a really interesting contact between what we're digging in the ground and the Bible. And in general, it just sort of illuminates what the lives of the Philistines were like.
So, yeah, I was thinking about, as you're describing this, with your background from the seminary, your teaching of religion, theology, and Hebrew, what goes through your mind when you're actually in the places where they would have encountered David?
Yeah, that's that's a big part of it, is just having that reality context. I like to tell my students that I spent my summers going digging through Philistine rubbish, and that's in a sense what we do. What is thrown away, we find. But is that a very immediate context? So for me, when I'm teaching, it's not an abstract place or a group of abstract people that I know nothing about other than what I've read or studied extensively in Wikipedia, but in the sense of these are real people. I've walked through their houses. I've touched their walls. I've dealt with their pottery. I've seen the remnants of their meals in terms of animal bones that are laying around. And so for me, the Old Testament world is a very real one. And it's three-dimensional, and it has sights and sounds and smells. And then I try and bring that to the classroom as best I can to make that experience more real for the students as well.
Okay. You also have led and are leading study tours to Israel. Can you talk about that?
It started out, my first one was in 2000. I've done three since then. I've got another one going this summer. So if anyone's interested, please give me a call or email me. But what we do is we spend about 2 weeks there. My goal was to have people on the ground long enough so they would get over jet lag and be able to actually appreciate where they are, have their body and mind in the same time zone for more than a couple days. So the first two or three days go by kind of in a blur because of jet lag, but then, you know, people are there and really experiencing and learning what the biblical world was like for about 10 days or so. So it works out really well. We have a free day in Jerusalem, and that kind of comes at the end of the tour so that people can do whatever they want. The first tour I took, the students came back. They'd already seen a lot of the old city of Jerusalem and previous walks around the city with me, and they came back from the free day so excited because they said, people were asking us directions, and we were able to tell them how to get to these places. And so they felt like they were old hands at the Jerusalem scene. But we cover everything in the tours. We not only study the dead stuff, but we New Testament and Old Testament sites, and I don't mean to be derogatory there, but we also look at the modern people. So we spend a lot of time with Palestinian Christians. We go to a Jewish settlement to talk to Israeli Jewish Americans, who a lot of them are, who are living in the settlements and kind of seeing what their viewpoint is. We go to a Palestinian refugee camp to get that perspective. Our guide is a Palestinian Christian who lives north of Jerusalem. Bus driver, Palestinian, sometimes Muslim, sometimes Christian. And we hang out with those guys at nights in the hotels. And so we have a lot of time to chat with them and find out what their lives are like. So it's kind of encompasses not only the ancient material, Crusader material, early church material, and Old and New Testament material, but also what some people call the living stones, the people who are there today.
That sounds terrific. And when is the next one coming up?
It's coming up this summer. We leave May 31st. And so we come back, I think, in the middle of June, June 14th or 15th. We have a good mix of people. We generally have about half students and maybe as many as half students, but usually about one-third students, two-thirds, what I call more mature adults, alums, people not connected with Concordia, just people who are interested. And it's a really dynamic mix. The more mature members get a kick out of the students and their energy and their vitality and liveliness, and the students appreciate the more mature perspectives, more wise perspectives that the older people bring to the tour as well.
Okay, and this would be open for anyone?
Open for anyone, yeah.
Would wish to join you?
Yeah.
Okay, and so if someone listening, if they were interested,
they could email me at mark.meehl@cune.edu.
Okay, and Meehl is spelled?
M-E-E-H-L.
Okay.
And thank you for that plug.
And what's the cost of the trip?
The cost is about $4,800. It covers everything except lunches. So it covers airfare over and back, all our hotels, breakfast, dinners. The food is really good. You can eat Middle Eastern. You can eat Western. We usually have buffets and such. And we have a traditional St. Peter's fish dinner on the Sea of Galilee. We putz around the Sea of Galilee. We pretty much see everything of biblical importance.
Well, it sounds like a great opportunity.
Yeah, it is. A lot of good walking. So we walk between 3 and 4 miles a day. Not all at one time. We're on the bus, off the bus.
And for people who might be concerned about safety?
Well, as we've seen in recent events in this country, it's safer than going to church in Tennessee or maybe even going to a concert in Las Vegas or even going to school. We have more people killed in those venues in this country than tourists in Israel. So there hasn't been a tourist injured in Israel probably in the last 30 years. So we stay very safe. We, you know, both the guide and I don't want to take people into areas of danger. We're kind of on the tour route. So in our guide, if there's anything that happens, he will know a group that's been there the day before. They'll call each other and find out what's going on.
Okay. But
so far, we haven't had any problems. And there's so much to see in Israel that even if we can't go to one spot, there's tons of other things we can see elsewhere. So it's not like we just sit and twiddle our thumbs for a day.
No, that does sound terrific.
Yeah.
Want to shift gears just a little bit here. You have some fascinating stories about your father.
Yeah.
And about his experiences in World War II as a B-17 crew chief.
Mm-hmm.
So can you tell us a little bit about that?
My father, as you said, he was a crew chief mechanic, works on B-17s. He was a farm boy in background, so he had a mechanical aptitude, and the government put him to good use when they drafted him. And And so he was shipped over to England and served in the 384th Bomb Group. And my brother and I, we knew he had done this, but we didn't really care about what he had done in the military, of course, until he passed away. And then we got very interested in what he had done. And so we've become members of the Bomb Group Reunion Association, and we attend the reunions and we talk to guys. And it's just there's all kinds of fascinating angles to it. In one way, it kind of keeps our memory of our father fresh, because in a sense, these veterans that we talk to are, in essence, of our father's generation and represent that bond. Also, these guys have just incredible stories. The ones who are still alive are in their 90s. I just met a guy this last weekend, who he's 92. He's survived and lived to be 92, which is interesting. He's survived 35 combat missions. He survived being shot down. He survived being a POW for about 6 months. And at the time he was 1920, so he sees the world through those lenses. And it's just been a really interesting experience for me to be involved with. And now, when my brother and I initially started, we were the only kids who were going. It was still all veterans. But now, at our last reunion, we had about 8 veterans and maybe 50 kids, couples and things like that. So now it's kind of become a club that we go to see almost. And but it's our goal is to preserve as much information about this as possible, about the group, about the guys, what they did. We're gathering it because we're interested. But hopefully we'll leave a big body of information. So if anybody's ever interested in what their ancestor did or what the group's history was like, they'll have one place to look for it. Instead of we've pulled together information from the National Archives, from bomb historian groups in Savannah, Georgia, from the Air Force Archives in Alabama. So now it's in one place.
And what was your dad's name?
Paul Meehl.
Okay. And you mentioned he, when you were kids, didn't talk about it too much.
He probably would have if we would have asked. But being a kid, you want someone who shot the guns. You know, what'd you shoot down? And all he did was wield a wrench and tools. So it wasn't very romantic to us as kids. But he had a great memory. He would have been a wealth of information if we would have ever bothered to ask. And a lot of times it is like that. The first reunion I went to, I sat next to a gentleman who was shot down on a raid over Schweinfurt in August of 1943. And he told me the whole story of his crew. I didn't know him before I sat down with him at the banquet. He tells me this whole story of his crew, how they got shot down, his time as a POW. He talked for maybe a half hour about his experiences. And at the end, I said, have you ever told your kids about this? And he says, they're not interested.
Wow.
So all we have to do is ask. They'll tell us.
Okay. So that's fascinating. And you are, as you mentioned, kind of the group's historian.
Yeah, I'm one of the historians and one of the archivists. And so if guys, they don't know what to do with their stuff when they pass away, if none of their kids are interested, they ship it to me. And eventually we'll have to pass it on to a museum. But for now, we're gathering it and kind of have this corpus of 384th Bomb Group material, papers, letters, photos. All of it gets scanned and put on the website for the group, but then also it's the hard copies are stored with me in my basement in Seward. And then we'll eventually ship it off somewhere.
And what's the website?
I don't know the exact address. It's 384th Bomb Group. Something.
And how many members of the unit are still alive?
Well, we had 8 veterans there, so 8 guys who are still alive and can travel. There's probably another 20 or 30 that are still alive that can't travel.
Mm-hmm.
About 10 years ago, we started a project. We wanted to get a piece of a B-17 that the guys could sign. And so a scrap dealer donated this wing panel, a panel from the wing. It's aluminum. It's about 8 feet long and about 3 feet tall, which was way too big, and we had no idea what to do with this big thing. So we made a crate for it, and somebody volunteered to paint the insignias of the group and the squadrons on it. And then we took it around to have all the veterans sign it. And now we have something like 170 signatures on it, and there's 3 guys left who have not signed it. And so once we get those 3 signatures, that's pretty much the end of our veterans. in terms of signing that. And then that will go to probably Hill Air Force Base in Utah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the signatures, those were all group members?
Yep. Okay. Yeah. Wow. So it's all guys who belong to the unit. And a lot of them are big name guys who held high rank in the organization. And I had no idea they were still alive, but they still are.
So, that's great.
A bunch of 90-year-old veterans out there.
Well, this has been fascinating. And anything else that you'd like to add?
No, it's a joy to work with the veterans. It's an even greater joy to work with our students here at Concordia and try and make that world of the Bible real to them, so it's not some abstract set of bits of data floating around on the internet to show them that there is realia behind the stories. They aren't just stories, they aren't just myths, but they're real events that took place in real places. And then also taking people over there to show them that as well, and watching people, for the first time set foot in the Sea of Galilee, or watching them as they walk through the streets of Jerusalem, is just a joy for me. I see that the lights come on and away they go.
Okay, well, thank you very much for talking with me today. And again, this is Dr. Mark Meehl. I'm Tobin Beck here at Concordia University in Seward. Thanks for listening.